I'd like to begin by saying that the way something is written and the way something is said indicates its meaning. And so I need to make that point at the outset. If I say, once upon a time, then you expect a story. If I say, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today, then you expect a funeral or perhaps a wedding. If I say, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways. You're expecting something poetic. If I say to you, open your Bibles to Matthew 7, then you expect a sermon. If I say, how many Baptists does it take to screw in a light bulb? You expect a joke. If I say, once upon a time there were three little pigs, and one of them built a house of twigs, and another built a house of sticks, then you expect to hear about a big bad wolf who huffed and puffed and blew their houses down. When we read the scriptures, we don't expect interesting little stories like that, like the three little pigs. But the reality is that Jesus was the master storyteller. And he always hit the meaning right on the head. Never crossed signals at all. Always communicated meaningfully. And so at this, the close of what some scholars would say is the greatest sermon ever preached, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus chooses to close this sermon with a simple little tale, sort of like the three little pigs. And nature huffed, and nature puffed, and nature flooded, and nature stormed, and at least one house fell, and another house stood. Who would not understand a parable like that? This parable and others showed that Jesus was fully acquainted with the human life, fully acquainted with human experience. He was familiar with farming, and so he'd tell parables about seeds and trees and soil. Jesus was a former carpenter, and so he would speak authoritatively about how to build a home. He knew something about everything. Farming, fishing, building, finance, management, the law. He knew something about them all. And furthermore, he used these familiar truths to make unfamiliar lessons known to humanity. And like so many of Jesus' parables, this one in Matthew 7 is a very simple story. And that's part of the wonder of the parable. Jesus' stories are so deceptively simple that we rush through them and we don't even think. One might impatiently say, of course, everyone knows that. But here's the rub. If we know the message and we don't act on the message, then according to Jesus, we don't really know the message. And so Jesus had just finished an extensive teaching that led to this parable. And the response to his teaching was mixed. He was teaching some very upside down ideas in the Sermon on the Mount. Clearly it was a call for change, a call for transformation. He was saying, instead of hate, I want you to build your life on forgiveness. Instead of revenge, I want you to build your life on reconciliation. Instead of being consumed by lust, I want you to build your life on honor and respect and purity. Instead of divorcing and breaking up a family, I want you to build your life on faithfulness, love, and forgiveness. Instead of hating your enemies, I want you to pray for your enemies. Instead of just being outwardly religious, I want you to live your life through secret acts of kindness, not telling anyone about it. So all of this and much more could be said regarding building a God life versus a human life. And the Sermon on the Mount is the Magna Carta of ethical substance. It is the crown jewel of moral teachings. No doubt these teachings came as a challenge to the religious establishment. They came as a challenge to the status quo, a challenge to the average life. Notice, however, there's no tentativeness in Jesus. No talk such as we hear today in the political correct world. Now, we all have a right to our own point of view, and every point of view is equally correct as long as it's sincere. No, rather Jesus acknowledges that one point of view makes sense and another does not. One point of view is full of wisdom and another is full of foolishness. And so contrary to modern thinking, not all points of view have the same value. How would you like to board a plane with the philosophy that it really doesn't matter what the pilot thinks about how to get there as long as we get there? No, I want the pilot who knows his way from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, not via Miami. Same could be said about inferior belief systems. And I won't get into all of that in this day of Islamic extremism. But we need to be clear about who we are as believers, and we need to be clear about the wisdom that our religion represents. And notice that Jesus does not commend the foolish for being sincere about what they believe, because sincerity doesn't often help when one is terribly wrong or misguided. Nor does Jesus suggest that there are a multitude of ways of looking at all matters. Quite simply, he says, there is a wide path, that path leads to destruction. There is a narrow path, that path leads to life. There is a wise way, and there is a foolish way. And it's in this parable that Jesus makes some staggering claims about himself. He's saying that unless a person takes him as their master, and not only hears what he says, but does it, eventually they will come to ruin. This is a matter of enormous significance. And some matters in life are like that. The biggest issues of life are not like choosing between several brands of cereal or different brands of peanut butter, chunky or smooth. No, the big issues of life are so vast in their ripple effect that those who choose rightly are said to be wise, and those who choose wrongly are said to be fools. And this is a very hard language for the modern mind. But since we have only one life, I personally am glad that Jesus spells things out so, ever so clearly. And having had both times of wisdom in my life and times of utter foolishness in my life, I am glad also that God is full of mercy and grace and new beginnings. But let's look at the parable. Some people said Jesus would hear what he'd have to say and they would act upon it, while others would do little or nothing about it. And Jesus describes these two contrasting responses with strong language, very strong language, wisdom or foolishness. In each story, a person builds a house. That's not up for grabs. Each builds a house. And the key point of the application is that we are all house builders. Every single person here today is a house builder. And in this parable, we get a picture of the homes being compatible in every way except one. They both are apparently well built. Both persons, I believe, took care to build the kind of house that they would want to have built, because they're going to live there. It's their house. The big difference is that one house is built on a rock and another is built on sand. Someone like me, who's not a handyman, who fumbles to turn a wrench, who doesn't know the difference between a sledgehammer and a claw hammer, might not notice the difference in the building of this house. I know a bunch about homiletics. I know a lot about communication. I know something about theology. I know a lot about sports. But I don't know about gravel and concrete and sand and foundations. So if I were buying a house, I would easily be fooled. But not the people Jesus spoke to. Because these are people who know the land and they know the property. They know where to build and they know where to avoid building. So if they've made a bad choice, it's not for lack of knowledge, but rather lack of judgment. And this is why Jesus calls these people foolish. Because they have erred as a deliberative choice. Some people, Jesus said, would hear what he had to say and they would act upon it, while others would do nothing about it. Some were wise, others foolish. The question is, why do some people choose to build on sand, which contradicts reason and sensibility? Why? Please notice, the difference in the two builders is not the difference in ability. It's not a difference in knowledge. It's not a difference of opportunity, but rather a difference of choice. Choice! One chooses wisely, another chooses foolishly. One chooses rock, another chooses sand. And at first sight, there may be no difference between these two builders. They may both be building decent homes, comfortable homes, attractive homes. And as you walk through the neighborhood, you notice these homes and you can't tell a bit of difference between them. You admire both houses equally. But one day there's a storm, a terrible storm, and each builder must face that storm. And we will all have those storms in life. You can count on it. One day, somehow, some way, somewhere, there'll be a storm. And so this parable is not about finding the perfect place, the perfect location to avoid storms. There is no such storm avoidance. This is a huge difference. We know that the storms will hit in our lives. We know that the sickness will come. We know that the accident will happen. We know that marriages will be broken. We know that friendships will betray us. We know that the economy will change. We know that jobs will be lost. We know that businesses will be lost. We know that at some time or another, we will be compelled to face a storm in life. And we are in one of three places. We are either in the midst of a storm, or we are coming into a storm, or we are going out of a storm. You will always find yourself in one of those three rhythms in life. And what is the first thing we say when we're in the midst of the storm? We say, why me? That's what we say. But another question might be, why not me? Why should I not expect it? Why am I exempt in my mind from the inevitable storms of life? And to live on this earth is to encounter storms. I had a stranger come up to me at a funeral, of all places. I was just ready to step into the hearse. And this very self-absorbed man, irresponsive to all the grieving around, as I did this funeral for a man who had taken his own life, comes up to me as I'm about ready to get into the hearse. And he starts to talk to me incessantly about his own personal problems. Irrespective of all the grieving going on around him, he could only focus on his personal problems. And I asked him in that place and in that time, would you like to go somewhere where you can be rid of all of your problems, all of your difficulties, all of the traumas that are now confronting you? Would you like to go someplace to escape all of that? And he seemed rather excited. And he said, why, yes, of course. And then I said, well, then just follow me and the rest of this crowd to the Woodlawn Cemetery. And there behind those big wrought iron gates are thousands of people who are buried, who no longer have any difficulties, any problems, any traumas to contend with anymore. Because to be alive is to have problems. To breathe is to confront difficulty. And so as Christians, we are not exempt from the problems of life. It's just that we have a big, rough and tumble God, a God who made this universe, who promises, "I will be with you in your storm." That's what we have. And the world doesn't have that. And I'll still the inner storms in your life. And as the old spiritual proclaims, "I may tremble on the rock, but the rock does not tremble under me." And so Jesus promises to walk with us through the storms of life, to walk through the valley, to walk through the sunshine, to walk through the shadow. As our second hymn proclaimed, "I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. On Christ, the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand." Did you think about that when you sang it this morning? Or did you just mouth the words? And friends, it's not often until the storm comes that we learn the quality and the strength of our house. The strength is tested. The foundation is tested. One man builds on a rock, another man builds on sand. Or as Luke says, one man dug deep and laid his foundation on the rock, while the other built his house on the ground with no foundation. And we wonder how this could be. Why would anyone know not to build his house in a place where there is no foundation? Why would a person deliberately choose to build on sand? Dr. Barclay, the great Scottish commentator, gives us some food for thought. "Why do some never get beyond hearing into the realm of action?" he asks. He has a few compelling reasons. He says, first, there's a failure to act with immediacy. He says there's a danger of feeling deeply drawn emotionally and yet failing to act upon one's emotions. There is a danger of listening to sermons and worshiping in the house of God and feeling drawn to God and never acting on it. But emotions cannot be substituted for actions. Any writer will tell you what, the greatest, the hardest sentence to writing that book, that first book, is the first sentence. The first sentence is the hardest to write. And once they're in front of that paper, in front of that screen, and they start that first sentence, then others will follow in streams of inspiration. And so when we listen to the gospel, the call of God into the various areas of our lives, our attitudes, our service, our stewardship, our getting rid of something that's holding us back, we must allow the moment of emotion to lead to a moment of change and action. And so immediacy is important. As the Marine Corps would say, carpe diem, seize the day. The second way a person builds upon sand, Barclay says, is by having a "it could not happen to me" outlook on life. And there's a military officer from the Second World War that said, "If I tell a group of 10 soldiers, seven of you are likely not to come back from this assignment." He says, invariably, some will say to themselves, "I sure feel sorry for those fellows that aren't going to return." Some people think that they will be apt to escape the storms. They are immune from the calamity. Still others, he says, build on sand because they're frankly very short-sighted. It's the inability to take a long view at one's decision-making. And it's those who want to take the shortcut to happiness that build upon sandy foundations rather than the long-term view of wisdom and digging deep to finding rock for one's life. And so all through life, we are confronted between two choices, between two goods, that which is good for the moment and that which is good for the long run. And it's tempting to choose that which is good for the moment. And most of our problems in life are derived from that propensity. It's tempting to choose the easy path. It's tempting to choose amusement and ease over discipline and preparation and the pursuit of wisdom. But when the months pass and the exam comes and the skills are tested, and the race is run, and adversity visits my life, then which one was the better of the good choices? Good for here and now, good for the moment, or good for the long haul? But know this, regardless of what good choice we make, our foundation, Jesus says, will be tested. And so beware of short-sightedness. That's what the scriptures teach. And finally, there are those who choose to build on the sand because they're more concerned about outward appearance than they are the foundational wisdom of faith. Their primary motivation is a material world and wanting to impress others with outward success. I once heard a realtor say, "It's much easier to sell cute bathroom fixtures than it is to sell the pipes that deliver the water to the bathroom." Why? Because that's what we see. And so this parable is not about appearance, it's about a strong foundation. Some choose to build on sand, and some build on the rock. Some choose to listen to the word of wisdom, the word of God, the word of Jesus, and put it to practice. And he likens them to wise people, and to those who don't, he likens them to fools. And we ask ourselves in closing, why such a hard word? Why such a hard word from Jesus, who's all compassionate and loving? Why must he speak so hard? And that's because he understands the supreme value of a house. For most of us, our most valued possession is the house. If this man had been building a chicken coop, it wouldn't have mattered. But this man is building a house. A chicken coop doesn't cost much. It doesn't take long to build. But a house is a lifetime venture, and it's another matter, especially when most of us only get one house. Earlier in my life, I used to live as if I could have a whole subdivision of houses in my life. But that doesn't work. And misplaced affections don't work. I can't just move from one situation to another anymore. La-di-da, la-di-da, easy come, easy go. It doesn't matter. I can't live like that. And I came to my senses and I realized that life doesn't work on my terms. We're given just one house to build, one foundation to build upon. And so I take, for instance, the part of my foundation, which is my physical body, which is the least important. But it's magnificently engineered, isn't it? This body of ours is remarkably resilient. But we can feed it all the wrong stuff. And we can neglect sleep and rest. And we can become workaholics. And we can live out of balance with our own bodies. And we can ignore all the warning lights on the dash, which tell us something's wrong within our body. We're not caring for the temple of God as we should. We're not giving it time to recover in life. And eventually, what we don't take care of will come home to roost with health issues. And we don't live forever, so we're eventually all going to decline to some degree. But the reality is we can choose to build a physical house as best we can that is responsible and healthy. Or the wonderful thing called the human mind. What do I build? Now, I'm a pure amateur with computers. I will admit it, I'm not a geek. I'm not techno savvy. When someone tells me to sweep my hard drive, I'm looking for a broom in the garage, you know? When someone tells me to throw out my cookies, I'm saying, why can't I just eat them? Someone tells me, what kind of server am I using? I'm looking for a waitress, you know? This is just the way I am. And so I'm challenging the best of technicians when I call for help with my computers. But I marvel at this intricate thing that sits on my shoulders called the human mind. The human mind. And how I can use that mind for good or for evil. How I can feed that mind resentment or lust or hate or pettiness or meanness or covetousness until that wonderful thing that God has given me is used and abused and it degrades my life. Or I can yield to the counsel of Philippians 4, verse 8, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely and admirable and excellent or praiseworthy, whatever is of this quality, think on these things. Use your brain for these things and on these things. And finally, and most importantly, there's the foundation of the human soul. Clearly enough, this is what concerns the ultimate issues in Jesus' story. The decision we make regarding body and mind combined to shape the human soul. Eternal decisions. And if this house of ours weren't worth so much, if our bodies and brains and eternal souls were not worth this much, and if we were given a whole subdivision rather than one house, we wouldn't need to focus so much on how we build this one life. But there is no other soul like yours. And there is no other life like yours. And there is no other mind like yours. You cannot replace it. And therefore, Christ challenges us to build on this house, to build on this foundation in a way that will survive and thrive because it's the only shot we get. And that's the word of the Lord, and He told me to tell you.